Van Zeele-Kugler and Zweidner and so forth, Western scholars began to compare Chinese and cuneiform astronomical texts, in particular called Bisuld, in a paper entitled Summa Chen und die Babylonische Astrologie, published in the Ostasiatische Zeitschrift in 1919, compared Mesopotamian astrological omens with astrological portents given in the Qiji, written around the 1st century BC. He saw striking similarities of form, and since the Babylonian sources he was using dated to mainly the 7th century BC, he put forward the proposition that the idea of celestial divination originated in Mesopotamia and was transmitted to China. In the following decades, other Western historians took up the idea that some Chinese astronomical astrological ideas and techniques originated in Babylonia. For example, H. Chatley, writing about Chinese astronomy in a review article called Ancient Chinese Astronomy, published in the first volume of the Occasional Notes of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1939, remarked that, and I quote, "After the Bactrian contracts with China, one might expect some transmission of astronomical ideas from the West. Although there is no record of such in the Chinese histories until the 3rd century AD, it is a fact that many foreign curiosities entered China from around 40 BC, and we find in AD 25, Lu Xin producing an astronomical treatise, the Three Principal Calendar, which far excels its predecessors for accuracy and system, and antedates Ptolemy's Almagest by over 100 years. He continues later in the article, "To the historian of astronomy, there are questions of originality and parallelism of development, or alternatively, the importation of ideas from the West." Scholars are divided as to the extent of foreign importations, but it seems certain that some ideas and a few figures, numerical parameters he's talking about rather than individuals, filtered through to China from Chaldea and Greece in the 4th century before the Christian era, and again in the 1st century. After the introduction of Buddhism in the 1st century AD, there can be no doubt as to the influence of Indian ideas, but the community of notions as to the 28 mansions, the lunar lodges, between India and China in, say, the 8th century BC, leaves little doubt as to indirect cause at an earlier date. And I end the quote. So Chaplin's view is basically that there was transmission of astronomy from Mesopotamia to China, and probably India to China as well, in this early period, though interestingly he doesn't consider the possibility of transmission in the other direction. In particular, he links one of the key developments in Chinese mathematical astronomy, the Sang Tong Li, or Triple Concordance Calendar, devised by Lu Xin in the 1st century AD, with Western influence. I should point out, recent scholarship has shown that this system is very much within the tradition of Chinese mathematical astronomy, and I think this idea that there would be any influence on it from the West is now being completely abandoned. Joseph Needham, in many respects the sort of dean in the West of history of Chinese science, in the section of his monumental series Science and Civilization in China concerning astronomy, also postulates Babylonian influence on the development of early Chinese astronomy. In particular, he posits a Babylonian origin for the system of Zhu, or lunar lodges. But again, more recent scholarship has argued for an indigenous Chinese origin for this system. The year before Needham's section on astronomy appeared, which was in 1959, Hum H. Dubs published a different view in an article on early Chinese astronomy in the Journal of the American Oriental Society. Dubs' conclusion was, and I quote again, "Down to at least Han times, then, Chinese astronomy was largely an indigenous development." That's the end of the quote. Nevertheless, several works have continued to appear, both by Western authors and by scholars in China, which have claimed Babylonian origin for parts of Chinese astronomy. Evidence for the transmission of astronomy from one culture to another is often hard to prove. Even the contemporary sources can be deceptive in claiming a foreign origin for an idea in order to add to its credibility. For example, in several Greek and Latin works, we find scientific ideas attributed to the ancient Egyptians, which are, of course, nothing of the sort. They're purely Greek or Roman ideas. Clear evidence of transmission can often only be demonstrated for either non-trivial numerical parameters, that are precise to many decimal places, for example, or cases of direct citation of particular observations, for example. The similarity of astronomical methods may not always indicate a common origin. For example, very similar approaches to the use of cycles to predict eclipses, or rather the vicissitudes at which eclipses are possible, are found in Babylonian sources and also in Mayan sources, and there's clearly no contact between those two cultures. So we have to always be aware that very similar astronomies can develop, very similar techniques can develop completely independently. The purpose of my talk today is to compare selected astronomical concepts and terminology in Chinese and cuneiform sources. The aim of this is largely comparative, rather than to investigate the transmission of astronomy from one culture to another. Nevertheless, some of the findings, I think, may be relevant to that debate. However, it's necessary to note that similarities or differences may not always indicate transmission or lack of transmission. For example, as I just mentioned, several approaches to astronomical problems have been treated in similar ways in different parts of the world that we know are completely independent. Furthermore, when transmitted astronomy is taken on by a new culture, it's often subject to quite dramatic changes, as we find, for example, with the importation of the Babylonian zodiac into Greece, where it's transformed very quickly into a geometrical system. The three topics I want to discuss quite briefly in this talk are the early stages of astrology, or particularly civil astrology, the language used to describe eclipses, and the language and concepts used to determine or define positions of bodies in the heavens. So let me start with celestial omens. The Shang Dynasty oracle bones attest to the early adoption of divination as a practice in China. A heated needle or brand would be inserted in a drilled hole on the back of a polished animal bone or turtle plastron, producing a pattern of cracks. These cracks would then be interpreted by a diviner, and the results of the divination, along with observed verifications perhaps, would then be recorded on the bone. The divinations were answers to questions asked by the diviners to their ancestral spirits. Astronomical references in the oracle bones appear only in the observations that are the results of the divination. For evidence of the practice of interpreting omens in the heavens, interpreting events in the heavens themselves as omens, we have to move on to the first millennium BC. The earliest extensive source for Chinese celestial omens is the Shiji, compiled sometime around the turn of the 1st century BC. Chapter 27 is a treatise on Tangguan. Now, later dynastic histories usually call this subject Tianwen. Many of you know in modern Chinese, showing up at all. I'll continue. In modern Chinese, Tianwen means astronomy, but in the context of early and medieval China, it's perhaps better to translate the term as observational astrology, since it's the study of observations of celestial phenomena and their interpretation as portents. What we might think of as modern astronomy, the observation and the investigation of the motions of heavenly bodies, was taken care of in another part of Chinese learning, the study of Li or calendrical astronomy, which we might equate with the Western concept of mathematical astronomy. Although written in the 7th century AD, the Tianwen treatise of the Jinshu is typical of the style of the Tianwen treatises in the Shiji and later dynastic histories. It contains the discussions of cosmological theory, astronomical instruments, stars and constellations, usually with astrological interpretations of what these various constellations correspond to on the Earth, and in particular within the government and the emperor's entourage, but also accounts of particular observations of astronomical phenomena together with their astrological interpretations arranged by type of phenomena. For example, an observation of a solar eclipse in 260 AD is reported as follows. A solar eclipse occurred on a Yu Yu day, fact, the 22nd day of the sextagesimal cycle, the first day in the first month of the fifth year. According to the prognostications of the Qing Fang Yi, whenever a solar eclipse falls on an EU day, it presages that the emperor will lose his power to his ministers, and that the minister of war will revolt against him. During the fifth month, the crime of Chen Qi was committed. Now, frequently the author of the Tianwen treatise will link an observed celestial portent with an event here on Earth. In the example just cited, the author links the observation of a solar eclipse with the assassination of the emperor by Chen Qi. Now, all celestial portents in China are directed toward the emperor and his government. An emperor only governed through the mandate of heaven, and it was believed that unexpected events in the sky were heaven's way of criticising the rule of the emperor, warning him that his rule would be extinguished unless he improved his conduct. Crucially, only unexpected celestial phenomena presaged real danger, and so the ability to predict an event in advance removed much of the portents from its occurrence. Thus, more easily predictable lunar eclipses were of far less astrological importance than their harder to predict solar counterparts, as is made clear in a statement in the Book of Odes, that the moon is eclipsed is but an ordinary matter, but that the sun is eclipsed, wherein lies the evil. Because all astronomical portents in China were directed towards the emperor, there was a clear link between astronomy and politics in early China. The recording of astronomical events was very often politicised, as is shown in this example that I'm going to read to you from the Huhan Shu. I quote, "The sun was eclipsed in the 22nd degree of the lodge Tung Chi. Tung Chi is the lodge in charge of wine and food, the duty of the wife." And it quotes, "It will be theirs neither to do wrong nor good. Only about the spirits and the food will they have to think. In the winter of the previous year, the Lady Deng had become empress. She had the nature of the man. She participated in and had knowledge of affairs outside the palace. Therefore, heaven sent a symbol. During that year, floods and rain damaged the crops." One result of the political role of astronomy in China was the manipulation of the astronomical record. There is strong evidence for the omission of astronomical observations in certain reigns in the dynastic histories, and even the insertion of faked events in other reigns. This was a way of criticising, the writers of the dynastic histories, criticising particular emperors for their own purposes. For Mesopotamia, we have two primary sources for celestial omens, compilations of celestial omens, principally the canonical omen series Enuma Anu Enlil, and omens cited by scholars employed as advisors to the new Assyrian kings, Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal. In both cases, the omens are written as conditional clauses, with the proceeds generally preceded by the dish sign, either to be read as a logogram for Shuma, if, or, as suggested by Erika Reiner, as simply a paragraph marker. Linking the proceeds and the apodosis is the conjunction Ma. The tablets containing omen compilations are generally set out very rigidly, so that the same signs lie under one another in successive lines. Well, you can hopefully see, as in the tablet Professor Cooper showed earlier on, the very clear systematic format with the same signs lying under one another in the variations. Just as we saw for the Chinese celestial phenomena, the omen apodosis of Babylonian celestial omens always referred to the country as a whole. The only individual mentioned in apodosis is the king, as his fate was tied to that of the land. Again, as in China, celestial omens were at times made of major political importance. For example, astronomical omens are one of the most frequently discussed topics in the correspondence between the Neo-Assyrian kings and their scholars. Unlike in China, however, the development of predictive astronomy in Mesopotamia did not reduce the importance of omens drawn from events that could now be predicted in advance. For example, eclipses. Indeed, there is a suggestion that the ability to know in advance that a particular celestial event was forthcoming enabled the Mesopotamians to make advanced preparations for the rituals related to those omens. In addition, the development of predictive astronomy may have been one of the factors that led to the tradition, or the new tradition, of horoscope casting. This new form of astrology is first attested in Mesopotamia in the late 5th century BC and existed in parallel with the older Enuma Anu Enlil tradition of celestial omens. Here we do have clear evidence for the transmission of the concept of horoscopic astrology or personal astrology from Mesopotamia to China through Sanskrit intermediaries. The earliest horoscope found in the East Asian source is from very late, from Japan in 1112 AD. Although we know several books describing horoscopes existed in the Tang Dynasty, these were translated from Indian sources. Let me now move on to the subject of eclipses and the language used to describe eclipses. The earliest references to eclipses in China are again found in the Shang Dynasty oracle bones, dating from circa 1600 BC. The character used to indicate an eclipse is an early form of Shi. Which carries the literal meaning of to eat. I think you can guess what it's saying. Hopefully it will come back. The use of the character with the meaning to eat suggests that the phenomenon of an eclipse was thought to be caused by something eating the sun or moon. Mythological explanations of eclipses along these lines are common throughout the world. In China, the idea of a creature eating the eclipsed body of the sun or moon influenced the terminology employed to describe eclipses, which became standard technical terms. For example, a total solar eclipse is indicated by Zhi. Now, in Matthew's Chinese English Dictionary, this character is translated as since or when or already to finish. But the character was originally a pictogram showing a man turning his head away from a plate of food, indicating that he was replete. Seems likely that the character was employed to indicate a total eclipse because of the parallel of a moon being finished and a creature eating the whole of the eclipse luminum. Other terms used by astronomers in China to describe eclipses are more prosaic. Kui Chu, lost begins, Shen, greatest, Fu Man, return to fullness, a very sort of descriptive words used for the various phases of eclipses. In late Babylonian astronomical texts, eclipses are always referred to using the logogram form An-Ku-Ten, to be read in Akkadian as Atalu, eclipsed, and apparently always to be understood as a technical term. Goetz has argued that related Akkadian words such as Adaru, to become worried or upheaval, are a secondary meaning or drawn from the association of eclipses with portended upheaval on Earth. So the eclipse, the word for eclipses, is used first in that context of just as an eclipse. There is no evidence of any mythological explanation for the language used to denote an eclipse. The eclipse myth did exist in Mesopotamia, however. For example, in the 16th tablet of the incantation series, Mutuku Lemnutu, seven demons are said to encircle the moon during an eclipse, covering the moon completely. But this myth is not reflected in the language used to describe an eclipse. Although eclipse mythology did not inform the choice of language used to describe eclipses in Mesopotamia, apocryphal rituals did. For example, the period of maximum phase of an eclipse is customarily referred to in late Babylonian astronomical texts using the logogram Ur-2, to be read as the Akkadian word Bikitu, weeping or lamentation. This refers to the ritualized performance of drums and the reciting of lament during an eclipse. Finally, let me move very quickly on to the concept of measuring the position of a body in the heavens. Now, defining the position of a body in the heavens is an essential part of astronomy. There are many ways in which the position of a celestial object can be measured. For example, it's possible to measure the distance between one body and another body, say between a planet and a star, along a straight line that connects them. Alternatively, one could measure the altitude of a body above the horizon and combine this with the measurement of its azimuth along the horizon to produce a coordinate pair. Or one could measure a pair of coordinates in the sky in some invisible reference system, as we do today. The choice of one system of measurement over another may be a reflection of the cosmological framework in which one is working, or simply a matter of convenience depending on what instruments are available to help in the task. Throughout Chinese history, the main system for defining the position of a celestial object was using the Shu or lunar lodges. These are a division of the sky into 28 zones, each defined by a determinant of star. The zones are unevenly distributed. They have, some of them are quite large, some are very small. But they're all lined up in parallel around the celestial equator. The origin of these this system, this lunar lodge system, is not known, but it's possibly they originally just abstracted from constellations. However, by the Han period at least, they were linked to the celestial equator, called the Qidao or the Red Road. The celestial equator was taken as a reference system for almost all of Chinese astronomy. Now, the celestial equator, I should explain, is, in modern terms, a projection of the Earth's equator out into space, and so reflects the daily rotation of the Earth. In Chinese, early Chinese cosmology, we have a flat Earth concept, so the celestial equator has a slightly different meaning, but it's comparable in terms of its significance in the sky. Within the various calendrical systems of mathematical astronomy employed in China, solar, lunar and planetary motions were always calculated along the equator, although as early as the 1st century AD, the problems with doing so had been noted by Jia Kui in a memorial submitted to the emperor. And I quote, "Your servant has previously submitted a memorial pointing out that when Fu An and his colleagues used the yellow road to measure the positions of the sun and the moon at half and full moons, they were mostly correct. But the astronomical officials who used the red road were not in agreement with the sun and moon. The red road is the middle of heaven and is 90 due from the pole. It is not the path of the sun and moon, and the effect alleged above is because one has used an incorrect standard to measure the sun and moon and missed the real motions." Jia Kui is correctly pointing out that the sun and moon do not move along the celestial equator. The sun moves along the Huangdao, the yellow road, the ecliptic, in modern terminology, and the moon and the planets move along similar paths, running more or less parallel or above and below this ecliptic. Nevertheless, the ecliptic only played a secondary role in Chinese astronomy, and all movements were translated into much more complicated movements relative to the equator. The terms used to refer to the equator and the ecliptic, the red road and the yellow road for the ecliptic, may have their origins simply in the coloured lines drawn on star maps during the Han period to indicate the equator and the ecliptic. The orbit of the moon was often called Beidao or white road. Measurements of positions in the sky used the angular measurement Du, where Du is defined by equating the number of days in the year with one complete revolution of the heavens. Thus, a Du corresponds to slightly less than 1 degree. The actual extent of a Du varied at different periods as different lengths of the year were adopted in different calendars, different standard values. For example, in the Sifen Li, promulgated during the Eastern Han, there were 365 and a quarter Du in a circle, whereas in the Xuanxi Li, used during the Northern Liang, there were 364 and 1,759 over 7,200 Du in a circle. The angular measure Du was used only for measurements parallel to the equator. For other distances, such as those perpendicular to the equator, linear measurements such as Qi or foot and its multiple Zhang or 10 feet were used. As we will see, a similar distinction between east and west and north-south measurements appears in Babylonian astronomy. In contrast to its importance in Chinese astronomy, the celestial equator does not feature directly in Mesopotamian astrology. Astronomy. Indeed, there is no term corresponding to the equator in cuneiform that I am aware of. However, the concept of the daily rotation of the sky and the stars that cross the meridian at the same moment is found in several aspects of Mesopotamian astronomy, in particular with the concept of the Zigbu stars. Several texts contain lines of simultaneously culminating stars and are listed at the same time intervals between the culmination of certain stars. In the late Babylonian period, celestial positions are generally recorded in one of two systems, using distances above, E, abbreviation for Elat, or below, using with the logogram Sig, and occasionally in Igi, in front of, or R, to behind, one of the so-called normal stars. These are a group of reference stars, about 30 of them, spread around the sky. They're used for reference stars for positions. Okay. A second form of measurement in the sky was to use the zodiac. And the zodiac develops in Babylonia out of a system of constellations, And it's an abstract system, the same as we use today, where the sky, instead of having irregular shaped constellations, is divided into 12 equal spaced units. Although the Babylonians used the zodiac, they did not apparently consider the zodiac as being linked to the ecliptic. Indeed, there appears to be no concept of the ecliptic within Babylonian astronomy. I've just written a very long paper about this, which has just appeared earlier this year, so if anybody wants, I can happily send them a copy of this paper explaining why there's no ecliptic in the Babylonian astronomy. Instead, we find that the paths of the sun, moon, and planets are defined as being within individual paths, malak, which have widths, but they are not linked together and have no common centre, which we would call the ecliptic. To conclude, the aim of this paper has been to compare a small selection of astronomical terms and concepts in Chinese and Mesopotamian astronomy. Although one must be cautious in drawing conclusions regarding the possibility of transmission of astronomy from one culture to another, I believe a few remarks can be made. First, it is clear that independent traditions can be very similar. For example, historically and textually, I see no evidence that Chinese celestial divination originated in Babylonia. Nevertheless, in both cultures, the heavens were used to provide portents, and in both cases, these portents were at times exploited for political purposes. Secondly, there were clear differences between how the Babylonians and the Chinese conceived of celestial measurement, unsurprisingly given their different cosmologies. Although this would not preclude the transmission of astronomical knowledge from one culture to another, it would make it significantly harder, and does, I think, place the onus on historians claiming for a transmission of Babylonian astronomy to China to explain how this problem was overcome. Thank you.
You just made it on time, but do we have time for a 1 minute question? Are we very strict on the time?
Of course, I'm going to ask the 364 question.
Yes.
You said there were 364 do?
No, it's the length of the year, so it's 365 and a quarter.
When did they get directly to that, or is there intermediate?
There's 365, and then there's 365 and a quarter, which appears in the... basically, all of the early calendars adopt that the quarter remainder excess. And then later on you get more accurate. But they're usually not actually more accurate. They're sort of fiddled to be more precise. They're not necessarily more accurate. They're just going to greater precision.